Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. And apologies for my cold-ravaged voice today. Two interviews up, as usual. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the journalist Mark Ames, author of the book Going Postal, for a fresh perspective on rage shootings. His work on school and workplace murder doesn't map exactly onto the Tucson tragedy, but it does help us understand this kind of spectacular public violence, which has become pretty familiar over the last 10 or 15 years. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Jefferson Cowie, author of a new book, Stayin' Alive, on the politics of the 1970s. The horrendous shootings in Tucson have certainly inspired a lot of drivel from the commentariat. They're heartrending, but please, let's not draw bad conclusions from them. Perhaps the most annoying has been the call for a return to civility. Well, no, I don't feel like being civil. I like being rude. The problem with the rudeness in American political discourse is that it's often so stupid, not that it's so rude. The idea that politics can be civil is a fantasy for elite technocrats and the well-heeled. I'm reminded of something that Adolf Reed once said to me, characterizing a mutual acquaintance as the kind of person who thinks that if you could just get all those smart people together in Martha's Vineyard, they could solve all our social problems. But of course they couldn't. Margaret Atwood once wrote that politics is about power. Who's got it? Who wants it? How it operates? In a word, who's allowed to do what to whom? Who gets what from whom? And who gets away with it and how? That's the end of the quote. There's no way that kind of relation could be rendered civil. The field of politics is constituted by vast differences in interests and preferences. Much of the time, we don't talk about these things directly or explicitly. We talk about them in caricature or euphemism, or take things out on scapegoats. Some of the so-called left, such as it is using Obama's speech in Tucson the other day as an excuse for rediscovering their crush on Obama. On the Nation's website, who was a rich source for this sort of thing, John Nichols wrote this: "It's been said that Obama strives for a post-partisan balance, but this was Obama speaking as a pre-partisan, as an idealist recalling a more innocent America, and imagining that some of that innocence might be renewed as shocked and heartbroken citizens seek to heal not just a community, but a nation that is too harsh, too cruel, too divided. For a few minutes on Wednesday night, we dared with our president to answer cynicism with idealism, to answer tragedy with hope, to answer division as one nation, indivisible." That's the end of the quote. Really, John, when was this nation ever innocent? When we were trading in slaves and killing Indians? What act of healing will make this nation less divided? The rich and powerful have a lot of money and might, and they're not going to give it up easily. Elsewhere on the nation's website, Ari Berman actually used the phrase "better angels" to characterize the president's rhetorical targets. I said targets. That reminded me of Alexander Coburn's great characterization of the role of the mainstream pundit, to fire volley after volley of cliché into the densely packed prejudices of his readers. But it's clearly not just the mainstream pundit, so too alternate pundits. It's not just that these stock phrases grate on the ears. Their use is a symptom that their speaker just isn't thinking. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Mark Ames. That was a bit of I Got a Gun by Jarbo from her 1995 album 13 Masks. On to the first interview. Mark Abe spent most of the 1990s and 2000s living in Moscow. From 1997 to 2008, he edited a newspaper called The Exile, for quite a bit of that time in partnership with Matt Taibbi until they had a falling out. The tone and content of the paper was extremely uncivil, and rightly so, since they were living in a country that was falling apart during the 1990s, a collapse that created mass poverty and a small stratum of extremely rich oligarchs, and which recovered in the 2000s only thanks to a strong dose of authoritarianism. Ames left Russia in 2008 after the government made it clear that it had had enough of his newspaper. It's since been reborn as a web publication, The Exiled, with a D, which you can find at exiledonline.com. In 2005, Ames published a book called Going Postal, which looked at the frequent murderous rampages we see in schools and workplaces. His argument was that these were not random acts by lunatics, but actions with real social causes. He seemed like a good person to call in the wake of the Tucson murders, when the media, corporate and alternative, were mostly bloviating rather unhelpfully. Ames mentions in the interview that the Arizona economy is a wreck. It is. It was a major epicenter of the housing bubble and has now become a major epicenter of the bust. During the 2003 to 2007 economic expansion, the number of jobs in Arizona grew by 17%, nearly three times the national average, and the fourth highest of any state in the country. But the bust has been equally savage. The state lost almost 10% of its jobs between the onset of the bust and the national employment trough at the end of 2009. That decline was about twice the national average. Since then, Arizona's recovered a bit better than the rest of the country, but it's still nearly 10% below where it was at 2007's job peak, making it the third worst performer on that measure of any state, exceeded only by Nevada, another housing bubble and bust state, and Michigan, which has been suffering from the auto industry. Okay, now Mark Ames. I know the Loftner shooting doesn't fit exactly the model of the workplace and the school shootings that you've written so well about, but let's start by talking about those, just because I think it's an important thing to keep in mind when we talk about rage and evil and all these vague words that people throw around. So let's talk first a bit about Going Postal, the title of your book from several years ago. What is it about the post office that gave its name to these workplace shootings?
Well, these rampage shootings, the modern sort, what's so different about our modern rampage shootings, besides the fact that they recur so frequently, is that for the first time over and over, you know, middle-class people were going into their workplace or their schoolyard and blasting everybody and then oftentimes blowing their own brains out afterwards. You know, most people just decided, well, they're just wackos. First, you know, these started in post offices in the mid-80s, and all of a sudden there were just a spate of massacres in post offices. I mean, the first shooting started 83, 84. The first really big massacre was in Oklahoma in 1986. I believe like 14 people were killed in that one, and these shootings just kept going on with increasing frequency in post offices, and they kept getting crazier and crazier. There was one postal worker in Boston who commandeered a light plane and literally took the plane and swooped down on his post office on his plane, firing from out the window. There was another postal worker in New Jersey around that time who killed his supervisor with a samurai sword. And finally, in popular culture and in the media, they just decided, oh, well, that must mean postal workers are a bunch of crazy people, without asking why, what changed. Finally started coming out in the early 90s that actually a lot had changed, that the Postal Service had become a really horrible place to work at. There were congressional reports about all the bullying and harassment and so on. And this all went back to when Nixon basically broke the union in 1970-71. I don't know if you remember this. I was too young, but I read about it. You know, they had to bring out the National Guard. There were huge strikes across the country, and particularly in New York, they were pretty nasty. And Nixon succeeded in pretty much breaking the union in that they're not allowed to strike anymore. You know, they get collective bargaining rights, but they're much weaker than they used to be. And with that came a new culture of bullying and harassment. And on top of that, they were subjected to competition. You know, competition was opened up with FedEx and UPS and so on. And they were supposed to, the Postal Service was supposed to start running on its own profits by 1983. So they forced people to work a lot harder for less pay, as started to happen later with in the private workplace. And it's interesting, 1983 was the first postal shooting where a worker went crazy and started shooting some of his co-workers and supervisors. This was in South Carolina. And that was the first year they were supposed to run on their own profits or revenues. And the first real sort of worker-on-worker workplace massacre in the private sector took place in Kentucky in 1989. So this is at the end of the Reagan, or at least of Reagan's term. And as we know, everything changed under Reagan. Massive wealth inequalities, the workplace culture became much better for executives and much worse for everybody else. People worked harder, got less pay, had fewer rights. And in this particular company, Standard Gravure is a printing press for the Louisville Courier Journal. You know, I went out there and I spent some time and got to know some people who worked there. One of the interesting things about this that makes these shootings so different from, let's say, serial killers is how often people, even victims, how often they have sympathy for the killer. You don't have that with serial killers, and that's why I always find these attempts to profile these people or try and bracket it all in psychology terms, like the paranoid schizophrenic or whatever. It doesn't quite hold up. There's something bigger going on here because nobody has sympathy for John Wayne Gacy. Those people were just sick killers. These are brand new, and they arise out of a worsening culture, a worsening world for most people, most workers. And eventually it made it to the schoolyard, and it wasn't just ghetto schools where gangbangers were shooting each other. It was white middle-class kids blasting each other. And usually what we found out was that in these schools there was a culture of really pretty horrific bullying tolerated by the administration, bullying, harassment, and these kids, you know, in a world where it's becoming increasingly competitive and increasingly divided up between a few winners and a lot of losers, it's gone down to the point where high schoolers or junior high schoolers, even grade schoolers, can start feeling like their lives are over if they're already deemed losers.
Now, with the workplace killings, you often read comments the next day, people say, but this is the last guy I expected to do something like that. He was such a regular guy. Is that typical?
Yeah, it is typical. Actually, with the first big massacre in Louisville, again, I think it was 8 or 9 people were killed in that one. There was, I think it was a supervisor of policemen, I can't remember, maybe it was a supervisor in the plant, said, I could have thought of 10 other people who I thought might have done it, because the union there had also been broken, people's lives, you know, they kept having to take pay cut after pay cut, and this guy was harassed, you know, unbelievably, brutally harassed. This happens over and over, and this jives with the fact that, you know, both the Secret Service and the FBI and others have tried to actually come up with a profile, and the way that they can profile serial killers to see who might pull off one of these rampage killings, and pretty much what they found is anybody can do it. They're family men, single men, women, African Americans, a lot of Asian Americans. They can be successful or not successful. They could be A students in school, on the school level. They could be a straight A students, or they could be authors. There really is no profile. One of the profilers on the list of characteristics or traits of a potential rampage shooter was no history of violence.
That's most of us, right?
Yeah, exactly. The Secret Service gave up on it themselves. Other people keep trying, and they always pretend like, oh, yes, but this fits the profile. But, you know, the more we're learning, even about Jared Lee Loeffner, the shooter in Tucson, every time after these shootings, at least in the media, they always create some kind of caricature of course, somebody who is always about to snap. And then the more you learn about them, the more human they become and the more familiar they become. And you know, and that's why in my book I decided you learn a lot more by profiling the workplace or the school or kind of the culture that created this brand new type of murder, this new like species of murder. You learn a lot more by profiling that the world around them than the actual psychology of the person. And I think it's actually quite obvious. I mean, inequalities, growing inequalities, create a more brutal societies and more mental illnesses and more misery. It's just it's just obvious, I think.
Well, in the case of the workplaces, too, there's often no outlet. Either you have a corrupt union or a weak union, or no, more likely no union at all, for people to express any kind of dissatisfaction, right?
Yeah, and not only that, you had a larger culture which was celebrating everything as people who were kind of moving forward, the winners and so on, were all the shareholders and the white-collar people, and I don't know. Media until 2008 was painting the Reagan Revolution and these new major premises about American life and the economy and so on. They were painting it as great. And if you weren't on board with it, or if somehow it was crushing you, you were a loser. And you weren't even part of the discourse or anything, you know. I don't think it was until that movie, The Office Space in 1999, which really bothered a lot of people. Because he burns, the guy burns the office down. I don't think it was until that movie that anybody even kind of was allowed to officially say, this life sucks.
Well, it always seems, though, that in workplace shootings, they go after their colleagues and not the boss.
No, that's actually not true. I sort of thought that, too. I mean, often the colleagues or, let's say, you know, the quote-unquote wrong people are the ones who get shot, but actually when you study each of these massacres in post offices and in the workplace, far more often than not, target specific supervisors or executives. The thing is, these people usually, I mean, they have been driven to despair in part by specific actions of some executives or supervisors, but it grows to the point where they get alienated by the entire structure. You know, the whole company. I mean, when you start getting targeted by your company, you start getting shunned by people who might have been more your friends before, because everybody's kind of in competition with each other in the current workplace, for example. And so it's very easy to imagine in their minds how they would think that the entire workplace is actually what needs to be killed. And so everybody then becomes a legitimate target. But what's interesting, even in so many of these shootings, including, again, the one in Kentucky, but many others that I've studied, even in Columbine, these guys will be shooting people, and then they'll see somebody who was good to them, a friend or just somebody who was decent to them, and they'll stop, and they'll say, you better get out of here, and then keep shooting. It happens over and over and over.
Well, let's talk a bit about Columbine. Why the schools as well? Is it similar to the workplace story?
Well, it's the same. It's a similar world. I don't want to try and make too neat of a theory, because then they fall apart. I want to try and stay with kind of common sense. And first of all, these school shootings, again, never took place before the mid-90s. I mean, there had been isolated incidents, but they didn't spark sympathy until mid-late 1990s. And the amount of sympathy for the Columbine shooters in online forums and so on, it's huge. Those guys are heroes to literally hundreds of thousands of young people.
I have to admit, when I was reading about that, there was one point where they said, all you jocks, stand up, we're going to kill you now. And as I recall my own high school career, I actually had a moment of sympathy with them, even, you know, all these years later.
Well, that's what first interested me in the story. I mean, and just to tell you how I first got interested in this, I mean, I was sort of like most people, thinking when these shootings happen, well, America has crazy people snap, whatever, this kind of grist for black humor, punk rock humor, whatever. When Columbine happened, it was in the middle of the bombing campaign against Serbia and the Yugoslav war, which I thought, I was living in Russia at the time, and I just thought it was the most insane, sick thing that I had seen after a decade of watching, you know, America plunder Russia, and then all of a sudden they started bombing Russia's, you know, closest ally. And I couldn't even understand how it happened. And then I flew out to America to visit a friend in the middle of the war and saw this media whipping up this insane propaganda about how the Serbs had massacred a million people and raped another million, all this crap. And in the middle of all this, there's this Columbine shooting. And what was interesting was, it just suddenly made me think, you know, I could see how somebody would do that. I remember hating my school intensely, hating the popular cheerleader types. And, you know, I had never thought of something like this before, but I could imagine had shootings started taking place at schools, I could imagine that there would be people who would have thought of that in my school as well. There's a lot to hate in a high school. I don't think it's, you know, it's it would be wrong to try to equate the workplace with the high school. But look, they are in some ways they are the same world. Kids have parents who are stuck in this horrible workplace. They're in schools and they're being squeezed much harder now than they were at least when I was in high school. In order to prepare for this horrible workplace in the future.
Yeah, they're hierarchical, alienating, and brutally competitive.
Exactly. So in that way, I think it does make a lot of sense that it would eventually filter its way all the way down and all the way up the generation or age chain. I mean, it's all part of one pretty wretched, mean culture. Things are just meaner now. When I started working on my book, it so happened I went out to Santee outside of San Diego, where there was one of the more well-known school shootings, and got a call from the publisher of the alternative weekly in the San Jose area called the Metro, that there was a bomb plot at my old high school, and you know, and I like to write about it. So I went up there, and I was amazed. I spent some time there at how different my high school was from when I was there. I mean, you know, one-third of the competitiveness was unbelievable. One-third of the kids had 4.0 grade averages. You know, the pressure from the top, from the administration level, to make sure that kids had the highest scores imaginable and the highest grades imaginable, that was intense because property values are so based on the school's ranking. And of course, the parents are all over the kids because they can barely afford to get their kids in these school districts. I mean, everything just changed so radically. Now this is Silicon Valley, so it's gotten, you know, obviously in the last 20 years, it's gotten extremely wealthy and competitive there, and it's a bit different. But, you know, these kids were complaining in school newspaper or on forums about how they were sleeping an average of 3 to 4 hours a night to try to make these grades and try to compete. And they were relieved when they got into places like Berkeley and, I don't know, you know, some Ivy League school, and how much easier it was, how much lighter the load was, which is insane. I mean, when I was there, the high school was a joke. We just had Prop 13. You know, my physics teacher was the wrestling coach. My chemistry teacher was the volleyball coach. I mean, it was kind of a joke. I was not prepared for when I got into college at all for the, you know, how tough it was. So everything is clearly a lot tougher in school these days.
Now, of course, all this doesn't map neatly onto Tucson, but does any of it?
I think it does, because the more we're starting to learn about Jared Lee Loeffner, the more whatever I might say or we might find out about him that might elicit some sympathy or understanding doesn't mean that he shouldn't be electrocuted or whatever the hell they do out there. I mean, you got to pay for your crimes. But that said, you know, you also want to understand why this happened or what sort of made him possible. And, you know, among other things, this guy applied for 65 minimum wage jobs last year and got turned down every time. And he worked 5 different minimum wage jobs at these wretched places, you know, these wretched, like, fast food places, like Winchell's or whatever. So it wasn't like this guy was facing a really bright future. And a lot of what messed him up, among other things, what seemed to have messed him up was, well, first of all, he was bullied a lot in school again. And studies show over and over that kids who are bullied in school are damaged for life. Usually they don't lash out. Usually it just stays with them and ruins them until the day they die. But lately some of them have started to lash out. So this guy, you know, he literally had kicking tape to his back when he was in school. You know, some kids said it was pretty brutal. And so why wouldn't you retreat into a virtual world? After that, you know, he had problems with women, but and what I thought was interesting too, this is maybe minor, but it just kind of stuck out with me. He got busted for possession of minor amounts of marijuana and I think a bong or a pipe or something. And this has really seriously hurt his chances of getting even these crap minimum wage jobs. Personally, I got arrested for marijuana and pipe possession when I was a teenager, when I was in school. And the record was expunged later. So I just assumed that would happen with any young person. It's such a minor crime. It shows, again, just what a mean, stupid society we live in, that you would just penalize somebody for life over that.
The liberals are all blaming Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck. What do you think of that?
They're horrible people. I'm all for bashing anybody who's horrible. It's obviously obviously they didn't do it. Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck are themselves just symptomatic of how much worse this country has become in the last 30 years. That's it. I mean, everything is meaner. If you look at any society, any third world country, you know, the worse inequalities get, the more the more powerful a tiny oligarchical elite gets. They always then try to drug the population with hate and turn each against each other. It's the oldest play in the playbook, and they're doing it with us. So I don't see them as the cause of it, but their symptoms are just a degenerate country.
Yeah, you lived in Russia as it was falling apart. Do you see any parallels with the U.S. today?
Absolutely, in every way. Poverty doesn't make people nicer. You know, it makes everything worse. You know, Russia went from, I mean, there wasn't really much inequality. And what's funny is, what got Yeltsin popular in the late 80s, early 90s against Gorbachev is that Yeltsin actually campaigned against the privileges of the Soviet elite. And they had privileges which were so minor compared to what the privileges of the oligarchy are today. They didn't have yachts and their own private Airbus 380s outfitted with jacuzzis and stuff, but they had nicer dachas and they got limousine rides in the Troika or something. And then when Yeltsin came to power, of course, he opened everything up to privatization, and suddenly you had 90-95% of the people dirt poor, scraping by, barely living, you know, a third of the country was on subsistence farming for a while in the 90s. And made everything meaner. It made nationalists much, much, much more powerful, much more popular. Violence went through the roof, and people started dying like flies. But that was all sanctioned and pretty much written by economists at Harvard, overseen by Larry Summers, and given the stamp of approval by Clinton in the 90s. And that was, I do see those similarities. I mean, Arizona, I was looking up their economy. It's amazing to me that nobody at all is focusing when they're trying to look at, you know, how this happened, what made Jared Lee Loeffner. Nobody's talking about the economy in Arizona. That place is a mess. I mean, in 2006, the Economic Policy Institute ranked it the state with the highest wealth inequality of any state in the union, which is really surprising when you think, because I would have thought Connecticut, New York, you know, where there are really, really, really rich people. Connecticut may be that today since Arizona's economy has fallen off a cliff. But, you know, they have the second highest foreclosure rate in the country, 1 out of 17 homeowners. You know, it's a pretty bleak, miserable place to live. And, of course, that breeds hate against outsiders, hate against government, hate against Mexicans. So, you know, if you want to look for the culture of hate, it's not just the guys on the radio who are kind of feeding off it, but what creates it are these wretched economic conditions.
That was Mark Ames, author of Going Postal and editor of The Exiled, exiled with a D, online.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. This is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back to talk about the 1970s after this.
Country DJs knows that I'm an outlaw. They'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. Loudmouth in the corner's getting to me, talking about my earrings and my hair. I guess he ain't read the signs that say I've been to prison. Someone ought to warn him before I knock him off his chair. 'Cause my long hair just can't cover up my redneck. I've won every fight I've ever fought, and I don't need some turkey telling me that I ain't country, saying I ain't worth a damn dough ticket that he bought, 'cause I can sing all them.
That was some of David Allan Coe's song Long-Haired Redneck from 1976. It's a good setup for our next interview with Jefferson Cowie, who teaches history at Cornell. Jeff published an excellent book about 10 years ago, Capital Moves, about RCA's multi-decade quest for cheaper labor. The book shows us that capital mobility is hardly a recent development. Now he's come out with another very good book, Stayin' Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, about a much maligned decade, a period that was a lot more interesting than it's given credit for. It started out as an extension of the 1960s, with a lot of mostly productive social conflict, and ended with a turn to the right and broad popular resignation. Cowie writes not only about politics with a capital P and management labor conflicts, and worker union conflicts too, but also about fights over what we now call the social issues. And throughout the book, he writes about how the popular culture of the period reflected all of these conflicts. The redneck hippie thing that David Allan Coe sang about is one of those. Because of a technical error, meaning I pushed the button about 15 seconds too late, the first sentence of Cowie's response to my question got cut off. I'd started out by pointing to the sad reputation the 1970s have as a time of bad fashion and bad hair, unfair because it was also a time of great political ferment, a lot of it within organized labor. Cowie agreed and then continued.
The energy and ideas of the new social movements were beginning to move into and challenge the mainstream orthodoxy of the AFL-CIO and the various constituent unions of the Federation. And in doing so, they began to press demands around union democracy, around health and safety, around quality of work life issues, around race and around gender, a whole basket of issues that had largely been sort of left off the table in the post-war paradigm of labor relations.
The mine workers are very important to this. What was this, the story of the mine workers?
Yeah, the mine workers are central, just as they were in the 1930s. They were the sort of the battering ram of change then, and they had the hope of doing that as well. Well, in the late 60s, a whole set of rank-and-file movements began to ripple through Appalachia and challenge the seated, rather authoritarian leadership of the United Mine Workers. And on the last day of the 1960s, Tony Boyle, the head of the United Mine Workers, had the insurgent mine workers, Jock Jablonski, and his family assassinated. And this actually triggered the biggest democratization movement, the biggest rank-and-file movement in labor history that actually marched all the way from the pits all the way up to the leadership of the United Mine Workers and fundamentally transformed the United Mine Workers. And what happened was that during these 3 years of struggle in the early 70s, it became a beacon for all the young people and people of color and women and things as a focal point for the change, the possibility of change in the 1970s, that you could bring those new social movements of the 60s in with the old sort of class-based vision of the 30s and revitalize unions and the whole meaning of what it was to be working class in the United States. So people flocked to the mine workers. A lot of young activists leaving the campuses and looking for new places to go look to the mine workers and join these efforts. And those ideas rippled through all sorts of other unions in the United States.
This is a period when the student leftists were to some degree industrializing. Some of the professional revolutionaries were going into the factories. Did that have any effect at all, or were these more spontaneous developments than that?
That's a great question. And the student left, many of the sort of radical youth were looking for a vehicle for fundamental social change and hitched their wagon to the labor movement as that vehicle. Others were more directly concerned with the welfare of working people. And I think it's actually the working people themselves who set the agenda and pushed it forth in the early 70s. But they certainly welcomed the allies in a sort of quasi-popular front way with the student radicals. I think a lot of the student radicals, though, hoped for more than could really be achieved even within the most reform-minded union movement of the early 70s.
Yeah, you say that a lot of the ambitious labor radicals had to contend with much of their work was just doing day-to-day stuff like handling grievances, right?
That's the dilemma of the American radical, right? It's many radicals go to work in community organizing and unions and things like that to fundamentally alter the political landscape, but they end up kind of doing day-to-day mundane things like collective bargaining, or if you go all the way back, say, to the the Wobblies 100 years ago, they spent all their time doing free speech fights, right? Which are all very, very important jobs to do. But it's kind of ironic that they end up in these reformist roles.
How much of that is just comes with the territory? How much of this is a feature of American life? Is there something uniquely American about this, or is this something you see around the world?
I think it is something you see around the world, but I do think you see a more extreme version of it in the United States. I mean, even if you take the period that we're talking about now that's covered by my book, if you compare it, say, to France, where there's a much stronger bond between workers and students in 68, and they see their cause tied to one another and their future tied to one another. You never really saw that in the United States that much. Those students who industrialized or colonized, as some called it, were a much smaller number than they were in a lot of European settings, and were a little bit more unique. So I don't want to make too strong a case for American exceptionalism in this regard, but I think there is all countries are different, and I think the United States is a little more different in that regard.
Now, you also write about how there was a consciousness spreading among at least the more active labor people that the contract and the mechanisms of collective bargaining were actually very clever mechanisms for holding down worker powers. It just left people focusing on minutia.
Right, and that's the contract was the sine qua non of post-war collective bargaining, right? If it's not in the contract, it's not an issue. Collective bargaining and the contract that it sought to achieve in the post-war period was as limiting as it was liberating. It provided bread and butter. It was very good at delivering money and propping up consumption, but much less effective at instilling a sort of democratic spirit and elan in unions and in workplaces, not very good at looking at issues of quality of work life and larger political questions that were so central to the time period, especially as the economy began to go sour.
Yeah, but before it went sour, there was a lot of attention paid to I'm old enough to remember this, but I think a lot of people don't know about it, the blue-collar blues, the Lordstown Rebellion, which were focused on very non-traditional sorts of labor issues. Talk about that moment for us.
Yeah, the blue-collar blues were virtually a media stereotype in the early 70s. Everybody went looking for the dissatisfied worker, and they weren't hard to find. And Lordstown, the interesting thing is what became known as Lordstown Syndrome, this disaffected worker who didn't like the deadening pace of the assembly line, was ubiquitous. I mean, they were all over the place, and that they were in the mines, they were all over. But it was Lordstown, this huge plant in Ohio where they made the Chevy Vega, the fastest assembly line in the world, that really became the media totem, the icon for the blue-collar blues. And what happened there was these sort of young, hip, interracial group of workers who sort of defied that Archie Bunker stereotype, who were sort of countercultural in their outlook, began to question why they had to just screw the same screw over and over again on the on these assembly lines where 100 cars were going past them an hour, and they began to revolt against the pace, the deadening pace, the dehumanizing pace of the assembly line, and people, the media just flocked to these guys because here was a new kind of worker who wasn't just interested in wages and collective bargaining as we were talking about, but really wanted to reimagine what the workplace could look like. And this went on for 3 weeks until it ultimately collapsed in a deal brokered between the union and General Motors, but a deal that left the core issues off the table still.
Yeah, what role did the official UAW play in this rebellion and the solution to the strike?
It was ambiguous at best. The United Auto Workers really did not want to see these types of ideas gaining popularity or gaining legitimacy. And so they were interested in getting back to work, getting the workers back to the line, getting production going, and which is kind of what their job was as junior partners in the post-war enterprise. And so to play that directly confrontational role was very dangerous. So they were very interested in cutting a deal with General Motors and getting these guys back to work. And they basically managed to get everything back to a kind of status quo ante, get things back to the way it was before all the rebellions began. and before GM reorganized production at such a horrendous pace, but really never wanted to risk anything in terms of any fundamental questions about how production was organized. And you can compare this with the biggest strike of the time, which was just a couple of years earlier when General Motors and the United Auto Workers squared off in this enormous strike, but it was just over wages and working conditions. The United Auto Workers basically all but went broke fighting that one. In fact, they actually had to borrow money to stay alive. But Lordstown, in contrast, where these issues were much richer and actually resonated with the rank and file in interesting ways, they wanted nothing to do with it.
Now, a couple of years later, of course, we entered the worst recession since the 1930s. There was the oil embargo and then a deep recession, massive unemployment. People were quite aware rather soon, as I remember, that the post-World War II boom was over and we were in different times. What effect did that have on the spirit of the labor movement?
Almost all the rank-and-file movements of the early 70s collapsed around 1974. You know, it was pretty much over. There was an enormous strike wave between 68 and 73 that really rocked the nation in a variety of ways. But when unemployment went up and stagflation hit, those movements really, really collapsed. And what I'm trying to do in the book is, rather than sort of tell a decade story, I'm really putting that shift in the center and sort of showing how the 70s are sort of half post-60s and half pre-80s, that we're really at a watershed in how the political economy is structured as of mid-decade of the 1970s.
I would think that the elites would not have been happy to see some kind of counterculture spirit spreading among the working class. I mean, it's one thing if kids on college campuses are smoking pot and criticizing the system, but if you got assembly line workers doing that, that's a whole different story.
Yeah, that's right. And this is when business gets organized as well. The business roundtable gets off the ground. The shift, or the upheavals rather, in the structure of the economy, the end of the post-war boom, as you put it, provides an opening for business to get organized. And they actually consciously model themselves oftentimes around the way labor had organized itself in the post-war period and began to. This is when you see the enormous increase in the number of corporate lobbyists and things like that who are all trying to get the upper hand in the way policy is made and the rest, to try and really close down whatever space existed for any kind of alternative questions outside the framework of post-war collective bargaining, and in fact do away with post-war collective bargaining where they could.
I'm speaking with Jefferson Cowie, who is the author of Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, just out from the New Press. So it's interesting that some people on the left look to hard times as a way of knocking the scales off people's eyes, and they're going to come to some sort of consciousness about capitalism and lead to a militant rebellion, or at least being more demanding. But it didn't work that way in the 1970s, did it?
No, it didn't. I mean, what we do is we look at the Great Depression. We say, oh, then times are bad, and the CIO got formed, and people were in the streets, and the left was on the march. That was a fairly unique episode in American history. For the most part, bad times are bad times. Actually, a tight labor market tends to serve workers' interests better. They can go get jobs elsewhere. They have greater bargaining strength in the plant or the store or the shop, whatever it is. And so the old slogan, the worse it gets, the better it gets for the left, I don't buy that one. I think the worse it gets, the worse it gets.
So we emerge from the recession, and Jimmy Carter is president. What happened to all that ferment that was going on early in the decade?
Well, Michael Harrington, the great socialist intellectual of the 1970s, of the 60s and the 70s, wrote an essay in 1974 in Dissent magazine called A Collective Sadness. And there really was a kind of dispiritedness that hit the land mid-decade. So the left saw itself as either seeking out various individual solutions, whether it was, going to some perhaps community organizing or retreating to some interior space of their own somewhere else. And Jimmy Carter was elected basically in the vacuum of the 70s with the Republic. Nixon was humiliated with Watergate, Vietnam, and the economic crisis, a little like George Bush was in 2008 with wars going poorly, economy going very poorly. And Carter steps in as kind of a new kind of Democrat. Here's a Democrat not only not beholden to labor, but not even really interested in labor's issues or unions per se. And he's very good on race and pretty good on gender, but really doesn't want to deal with class. He really doesn't want to deal with the economic questions in any fundamental way. And drifts for a couple of years and then decides basically takes a hard shift to the right. And this happens after full employment legislation is undermined and labor law reform is fails. And then in comes Volcker towards the end of his term, and inflation becomes public enemy number one. We forget about unemployment. And by the end of his presidency, I think it was not a hard calculus. If you want a conservative, let's take a real conservative. And because Carter actually did not offer that much as an alternative to what Reagan was putting forth.
Well, of course, we remember particularly the early 70s now as a period of tension between the hard hats, the rednecks on one side and the hippies on the other. I've got a whole collection of songs in my iTunes library of redneck v. hippie struggles. And I'll probably play one before or after this interview. But how faithful is that to what actually happened? How did we come to believe that?
I'll quote Michael Harrington again. He said that America was going left, center, and right at the same time. And it was a time of great confusion. There's no single narrative that can capture the confusion of the 1970s. But there were some very iconic moments, and probably the most important was when to answer your question, was when the hard hat demonstrators beat up these, rolled out of their jobs, descended on some anti-war protesters, beat them up down in the financial district in New York City, and held kind of pro-establishment, pro-Nixon, pro-war rallies throughout the month of May of 1970. This is all in the wake of Kent State. And that gave the Nixon administration the sort of iconography it needed, the hard hat who was a patriot, the working class guy, and they're all guys and they're all white, and who stands up for America and puts his country and his cultural values ahead of his material interests. Sure, there were plenty of those people. There were also, at the same time, there were the Lordstown guys who were trying to basically reimagine how the whole system should work. And all these currents are happening at the same time. But the one that, the Nixon administration and its tactics really glommed onto was this hard hat worker. In fact, even their campaign stickers were shaped like little pictures of hard hats with Nixon on them.
Except they forgot the union bug.
Exactly right, which is sort of the whole story in a nutshell. They printed thousands and thousands of these hard hat stickers and forgot to have the little union bug that says they were printed in a union shop put on them. I mean, it's because they weren't printed in a union shop and they ended up having to scrap them all.
Although I do have a Nixon bumper sticker, which does have a union bug on it, so I guess they learned their lesson at some point.
Yeah, they did learn their lesson, yep. Which also says something about, the transitionary nature of the Nixon administration. He still has a foot in the whole liberal establishment, just as he's helping to shift the country out of it.
But he also is masterful at orchestrating the resentment of the white male worker, not just in the South, but the ethnics in the cities and such, against what we think of as now just normal political discourse about the political elites is originated in that time, didn't it?
Exactly. And Nixon's whole hope, if you want to figure out how Richard Nixon worked, why Richard Nixon worked, virtually every domestic dimension to his policies had nothing to do with principle per se. All they had to do was him building what he called his new majority. He wanted to create a successor to the Roosevelt coalition, and he wanted to lead it. And that was everything else fell in behind that. Watergate, the liberal domestic reforms, economic policy, everything else was basically to prop up that vision. And by 1972, you know, he won in a pretty sizable landslide against George McGovern, brought in enormous numbers of white working class voters, and it did in fact look like he had created a successor to the Roosevelt coalition. Unfortunately, his own unfortunately for him, that is, his own demons dragged down his presidency. But what the types of shifts that we associate with Reagan in 1980 were really well established by 72.
And you've got a bit about how Nixon pressed the pot-smoking ex-convict Merle Haggard into service to promote a traditional agenda.
Yeah. Merle Haggard's Okie from Muskogee really is the song that defines that hippie v. redneck theme that you were talking about. Okie from Muskogee is a song that basically, you know, talks about morality and patriotism and living right. And Nixon invited him to the White House, and in one of the most awkward shows of the White House ever, where Merle Haggard was, you know, basically playing his honky-tonk set, and he said that the Nixon administration people sat there like the department store mannequins. They were just stiff as could be. And also, Governor Reagan pardoned Merle Haggard for his crimes. He had done time in San Quentin, and this was back when country stars often were actually outlaws, not just pretending to be them on MTV or country TV. And so Reagan also pardoned him. So the right was very attuned to using these cultural characters as political tools.
And this was also a period in which, within the Democratic Party in particular, but also in the broader society, affirmative action began to become very prominent. There's a lot of attention paid to race and gender issues, which had not been before. And you know, the traditional white male worker felt challenged and dismissed and marginalized by this. At the same time, you know, sort of class and economic issues disappeared out of political discourse. How can we think about this? Are gender and race issues a diversion from class issues, or do we have to think about all these things together? And what does the historical work tell us about that?
Right. That's the hardest thing we seem to be able to do as a society is to be able to talk about what we could call diversity, gender and racial issues mostly, and class issues, economic issues. We don't seem to be able to hold a discussion about both at the same time. We can, you know, in the 1930s and 40s, we were able to launch an entire set of policies around class and redistribution of wealth. But it was largely on white and male grounds. And in post-60s America, as the economy changed, we decided to put issues of inequality on the back burner, and we began to talk about affirmative action and made sort of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission trumps the National Labor Relations Act as the most important piece of employment legislation in the land. And the only way to get anywhere is to be able to have all elements of identity on the table at one time to move forward. And I actually, when I'm out in the world and I'm talking to working people, I find that's the case. They actually have transcended a lot of these limitations. But the way our political discourse is framed, there's almost no way to get a discussion of class and inequality off the ground.
And then finally, the title. You put a great bit of weight on the movie Saturday Night Fever as embodying or even shaping a transformation of consciousness in the latter part of the 70s. How's that work?
Well, I'm not going to make a case for causation. I don't think a movie causes anything, but I think a good piece of popular culture is in tune with a moment and illustrates what's going on very effectively. And I think Saturday Night Fever does this extraordinarily well. Tony Manero is a dancer who was first written about by a rock critic named Nick Cohen. And he wrote this piece in New York Magazine about the working class disco movement in Brooklyn. Unfortunately, although it was reported as fact, he made the entire thing up. But nonetheless, I still think it works very well. It was the magazine article was so popular it was made into the movie. And Tony Manero, played by John Travolta, is this, of course, fantastic dancer. And he is what the original author called one of the chosen ones. That is, one of the ones with the gifts to get out, right? And in the end, after he kind of navigates his way through this violent race, class, do and gender violence and rape, and, you know, it's just horrible. He takes an all-night subway ride and emerges in Manhattan. A new day is dawning, and he's managed to escape. And I think that's one of the key themes of popular culture in the late 70s, is that there's a few that are going to make it out. And we are going to, as a society, we are going to put them up on a pedestal, whether they're Rocky or John Travolta or whomever, and we're going to forget about everybody else. We can put the rest of those guys in the past. We don't care about them anymore. What we really care about are those individuals with the skills to get out, and we are going to put the rest of the working class in the past. And I think that is the tragedy of the 1970s.
So the working class, is it dead or just in a deep sleep?
That's a great question. I think, you know, the subtitle of the book is The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class. And I think that the subtitle is actually a question. And that question goes something like this. Was it the last days of the working class altogether, and that we are now just going to be in some sort of postmodern cultural haze where we cannot really get clear about these questions? Or was it just the end of a particular version of it? Largely white, largely male, New Deal orders version of the working class. And I'm hoping that it is, in fact, just the end of that white male version, and that we are clearing the decks for a broader, more inclusive type of working class identity that might be able to emerge in the future. But historians are notoriously bad prognosticators, so I will leave you with the question.
That was Jefferson Cowie, a professor of history at Cornell, and the author of Stayin' Alive, The 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, just out from the New Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with that Merle Haggard song we discussed in the interview. Oddly enough, I once heard an Australian Aborigine singing this song at an Aboriginal cultural center in Adelaide, Australia. It was explained to me by my host that Aborigines love our country music because it's about trucks, rural poverty, and loss. Till next week, bye.
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take our trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on Main Street. 'Cause we like living right and being free. We don't make a party out of loving, but we like holding hands and pitching woo. We don't let our hair grow long and shaggy like the hippies out in San Francisco do. And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee.